The ACN podcast is made possible thanks to the generosity of our listeners and sponsors, including the Agile Alliance. As a nonprofit membership organization, the Agile Alliance is an excellent resource to help you along your Agile journey. To learn more about the Agile Alliance and our other sponsors, as well as how you can become a sponsor or supporter of our show, please visit acnpodcast.org for more information. And thank you for your support. Everyone, welcome to the Agile Coaching Network. My name is Ray Arell, and I'm joined every month by a beautiful group of people that I have had the privilege of working with for a number of years now. The co-hosts, and as well as myself, we're helping to get the conversation going. I do want to thank Diana Jorg, Sheila Eckhart, and Sheila McGrath for being here today. The ACN is a member and sponsor-supported show that would not be possible without the financial contributions to our social enterprise. It helps us to pay for the things we need to bring you the show. If you are currently supporting us, thank you. If you would like to join others in that support, please visit newagility.com or acnpodcast.org to find out how you can support the show. And thank you so much for your listenership. To get things kicked off, one of the key things in the Agile Manifesto and the principles is this welcoming changing requirements even late in development. The processes are meant to and in order to give us a competitive advantage while using Agile, we structure the methodologies and the workflows that we do in a way that enables us to be able to, if a customer comes to us, even late in development, gives us the ability to be able to rapidly swarm on a particular change, and it should not be that impactful. Now, that all sounds good in the sense of a new product coming into existence. Maybe you have a legacy product that maybe that doesn't fit. My Agile journey started with one of the programs that I was running at the time underneath the group that I was managing at the time. Was the Fortran compilers. And for people who just suddenly said, Ray is old, yes, I am, but I inherited the Fortran compilers, and this is the ones that we used to optimize for Intel microprocessors. I inherited that group, and we had pretty close to several decades worth of legacy code that we had to go off and manage. And so the challenges that responding to changing requirements became, there were some real on-the-ground issues that as a new Agile team, we had to go off and start to address. A couple of the ones that I can think of, if we did a force field analysis of that, would be number one, rigid processes and frameworks. Even though we were converting and moving towards more of a Scrum or a Kanban model itself, we still had a lot of processes about how things got released. How did things get out of the factory that were not as flexible as how the team was running? So we would hit that brick wall of, okay, what does it take to ship an empty box of software out of the company? And we had to start to go address those things. The planning process and the flexibility of the planning process was getting better, but some of the planning processes were out of our control, meaning that we were a part of a platform. We happened to be one subcomponent of 24 other components that was delivering to a sort of a major timeline of the way that Intel worked was they had four or five market cycles that they had to go reach. And so there was this flexibility issue that took place that was above us. So we were subordinate as an Agile team to a pretty much a waterfall process that sit above us. The other one was, of course, with a several decade old code base, was that we were suffering from technical debt, not just technical debt that we wrote. Literally, some of the code was written by people who were no longer with us. And that's because they had been working on it until their retirement, and they decided to, of course, retire. What do you do with that knowledge? It wasn't just the question of in any legacy system. The learning curve associated to being able to even address that technical debt was a huge challenge for us. And so how do we design systems in a way that can grow effectively and address those particular issues? The other one was, of course, resource constraints. You never have enough dollars in order to do work. And then the other part, which I didn't put on this one, was the people constraint. And that is, again, expertise. We can only get staff a team so big. And in order to be able to get some of this work done, we had to go figure out creative ways of how do we support these requests as they come in and do that quickly. The last one is, and Agile prides itself on trying to move away from the contracts, but contracts exist within organizations. By the way, the this over this in the Agile Manifesto doesn't mean we don't have contracts. We have contracts all the time. And I'm pointing out two contracts in particular, one that we talk about all the time, which is the external contract that I might write with an end customer. But what about internal contracts? The contract of delivering something to an internal team, whether or not that be a, I don't know, if you have an SOW that you establish, a statement of work that you make internally, what's the implications if you don't meet that? Is that something where your team is put into, I don't know, purgatory for the company, or you're suddenly seeing that people are getting bad performance reviews because they're not meeting those expectations? Or how is that being addressed when the on-the-ground reality of, hey, we need something changed, contract is now different, how do we react to it? Is the default answer, and I'll say that most companies that I've worked with, large companies, the default answer is typically no. And if you think about this particular principle in particular, it's about how do we make the default answer yes? And what are the key things that we have to go shift around in order to go address this changing requirement and this sort of force field analysis that we're dealing with? So the questions to kick us off are, number one, do you have any different constraints than the one that I just ones that I just brought up? Are there other ones that also deserve to be on this list and deserve to be addressed? The next question is, what are the ways that your teams are addressing these constraints? What are the key, whether it be a method, whether it be how you work in the workflow that you currently have? Do you find that you don't pick Scrum, you pick Kanban, or you pick, you know, Fast, or you pick some other, you know, methodology because it actually works better for this? I'd like to hear your ideas on ways that these constraints can be removed for people. And then, as constraints are being removed, there's always something that's a big inhibitor. And it's okay, removing this thing is going to take a very long time. What are those inhibitors? And what are the steps that you're taking to work around that? So to kick things off on this, let's see. Sheila, how about you?
I think there is another one that goes on the list. And that's the rate of change that we're experiencing now. Because I'm thinking about working on something where we were using lots of cutting edge tools to do some development, and they were all going to have to work together. But while we were in development, those tools became semi-obsolete and newer tools replaced them as the tools of choice. So the team needed to go look and see, are these tools really better, enough better that we should go with them? Are they really the future? Because we don't want to be implementing something that's going to quickly become obsolete. And if they are, then what does that mean? Does that change our design? Does that change the priorities that we have for development? Does that change, how does that change what our end product is going to look like? And just doing the analysis can be pretty time consuming. But one of the ways we addressed that was to have a certain amount of time set aside every week for analysis and learning. I know not every company will do that, but in this particular company, they did commit to that, at least for the teams I worked with. And the other thing about constraints, if you're doing customer-facing product development, a lot of times you don't know what changes in the market are going to do to the viability of the product you're developing. So you have to maintain a certain amount of flexibility, but then you have to set expectations internally that this is our target date, but the target could change because it could turn out that the things we think we're going to do aren't really the right things. With product development, you do things like prototyping and beta tests and minimum viable product and all that kind of thing. And sometimes you don't make major changes, and sometimes you go, oops, we got to go back to the drawing board, and there's significant changes. Those are the, I guess those are inhibitors that I've run across the most that have the most significance. One other internal one, I have had a situation where a previous group with a previous product had promised that they, if a team would, an internal team would take on a semi-manual process, that they would come back later and fix it. They got disbanded. They didn't fix it. I had a lot of trust issues with those internal customers because they thought I was going to do the same thing. So I actually had to go fix some of the problems that had been introduced for a totally different product, because otherwise nobody was going to even consider my product. They were just going to say no.
That is interesting, because one of the things that I noted as I picked up projects in the past, yeah, the previous team, the sort of the legacy perception of your delivery performance as a company was already tainted the pool of your success in some regards.
It wasn't even the same product, though. This was a totally different team. The only thing we had in common was, well, and I wasn't even in IT. I was in operations working with IT. But the fact that another team had made a promise and not kept it tainted the relationship. And it's pretty common to have a situation like you're describing where something was supposed to be done in the legacy system a couple of releases ago, and it didn't get done, and it always got low priority, and it's making it very difficult for the people that are actually trying to use the process to be able to use it.
But did you find in that scenario, and I'm digging in a little bit on this particular one because it feels very real to me, that does that mean that the next client is now, or the same client that's coming back to you, now the contract is heavier. There's more penalties put into it. That's like it went the wrong direction.
They weren't even going to agree to anything unless I found a way to fix the problem that they already had that was left over from something that had nothing to do with me except that I was in the same division. But yeah, definite penalties, because I literally had to automate a process that had nothing to do with anything I was working on, but they weren't going to talk to my team. They weren't even going to consider taking on this process. They were ready to go to the board and say, no, we can't handle anymore. They were literally that up in arms about it. So, and that does happen. That's not really that unusual. And I'm thinking of another time when I had a problem with a cell phone company. I had to have the wired server farm and the wireless server farm talk to each other. And they both just kept saying no. I literally had to get together a meeting with a bunch of VPs in it, where they had to show up and actually talk to each other to find out that the problem was that neither one of them was familiar with the security protocols on the other server farm. And they literally had to go off and have, once I knew what the problem was, then we could set up some working sessions for them to get comfortable and figure out if there were any security gaps that needed to be addressed. But it took me maybe a month of them just stonewalling. And that had to be from something that had happened in the past. I just never found out what. I just had to deal with it.
So what toolkit got altered going through all of this? So you go through this stonewalling exercise. What is the one key thing that you bring out now to say, let me mitigate that moving forward? Was there anything that you came up with?
In organizations where I've worked, I've always tried to make sure that all the people who were going to be the active workers and all the people who were key decision makers, who were usually a couple of levels up, were aware of what was going on. And it was communication, really. It all came down to communication at the bottom line, that you needed to know who needed to know, what they needed to know, and when they needed to know it, and over communicate. And when you think you're over communicating, you're still not doing enough.
Okay. Thank you for that. Jorg.
So my thought, actually, one thing to mitigate this is curiosity. I just had the experience the other week that my team was asked to fix something that was 20 years old. And the first days were really painful because customer was asking, what's wrong? Can I continue using your product? So there was extreme pressure and they were really hamstrung. And then they figured out, yeah, you can keep using that. That would have been the point to stop. But actually people said, we are actually curious how this really works. Give us another 3 days to figure this out. And they actually fixed 3 longstanding bugs in that 3 days because there was no pressure at all, just engineering curiosity and the desire to be good at what they did. An important thing is to somehow exchange pressure for curiosity. And it's not easy most of the time. And the biggest hindrance in a way is you can't pick the minds of the people who've gone before you. And to mitigate that, I'm always trying to bring in people into reviews that have a basic knowledge of the topic, but they don't know everything. So if they look at what you're currently doing, they represent your future self or the future self of somebody who has to maintain your code. And the questions these people are asking are questions you should document because you will be asking them yourself in the future.
That's an interesting perspective. Then, just to give everyone a perspective here, what is your current role within your business? And are you the one that's participating in that? Or are you the one as the leader of an organization or component of the organization that's allowing that?
That's an interesting thing. I'm actually participating in being curious because that drives the curiosity anyway. And I'm still an engineer. And in the other thing, I'm allowing it in a way because I don't say how to do it. I'm just saying, think of this, what is in the future. And if you get something from the past, try to extrapolate it to what you're doing to other people who will get your stuff. So I'm just more or less getting a conversation going, and then I'm more often positively surprised by the great ingenuity that I see happening versus driving anything. Because as I explained, if you drive something with pressure, you destroy creativity. And more often as a leader, you're not as smart as all the people working under you.
That is a great person. You doubled down on greatness there, man. I love that. One other thing in this space, though, is because there are teams probably that are listening to this that don't understand the value of that. I used to write in my code or in my hardware design code, because believe it or not, when you do hardware design, it's still code, that I would write notes to myself in the future in order to remind myself of different things and bring it through. And I guess the question is if you had to think of that curiosity perspective that you create, how do you tell your future self to continue to do that?
First of all, by making it a joint effort. I always try to bring people together to do it and not to do it on your own, because there's always that point where you're curious about something, somebody explains it, challenge of writing it down. And that then becomes a team effort of what do I understand? What do I want to say? Especially if you're documenting it in a language that is not your native tongue, then it gets really tricky because some of the English comments a German person written from a German can read and totally understand, but they might not make sense to a native speaker in the direct sense. So even that gets challenging. So pairing people up and then obviously celebrating the success. If they say, we've done this differently now, look at that code. By the way, we're a bit scared that it's too many comments. Then you don't say, doesn't matter how many there are. You really take a look and you try to pick something that you say, even I, so far removed, can make sense of this. And that is actually probably an indication of this makes sense to somebody else. Things like that help a lot. But in the other way, it's just the challenge as procrastination you have every day, more or less. It's more easy to stay on the couch than to go out and have some sweaty exercise, because your future self to you is a foreign person, quite removed, while your current self is just craving that satisfaction. So you need to create a rather short-term satisfaction, either of discovery or of discussion or of recognition, whatever. And people are different. Some just crave the challenge of doing new things. Others just want to have a success, so somebody else needs to look at it. Not a perfect understanding, but learn what your people are good at and then team them up to be good at what they're doing jointly. If people say, actually, you've put us on this task together, and we thought that is quite a lot of people, but we saw that we could complement each other. Next time we'll complement each other automatically. Then you create an atmosphere that will drive this fun-loving innovation, so to say. And innovation is not meant in the terms of discovering tremendous things, but in small steps, like Agile is always about small steps.
I love that. It sounds like you're an endorphin junkie when you actually solve these things.
To me, it's actually more seeing people smile when they've done this.
That's beautiful, man. Love it. Talasi, are you there? What's your perspective on this?
Yeah, I mean, it's nice to hear different perspectives from different people. And I have a few points to add to this. I think that in these things, one of the constraints, I would say, the exclusivity. Like some projects fails because the exclusivity is being promoted by some team member, and the team member is in politically more powerful, and nobody challenged him. And then because of that, people leave that project. And then some of the new innovations brought into the table are being put under the carpet. That's one thing. And the other move I see is recently, if you look at the work done by in a North American situation versus in an Indian situation, right? So if you look at Google and other places, they actually want to save a lot of money, and they have this concept of the Indian Asian situation where they could do the project with one third of the resources the North American can equal, and North American can have it. So that is an advantage, and it is a joke that now is going around. So you send the jobs to India, and then we deploy AI in North America. So these are the things going on and influencing this, how these things have been used, and it's not just the team dynamics anymore. It's just, I think, the team dynamics plus the other things coming into play now because of this AI.
Just in that perspective, so I understand companies wanting to save costs, and the longevity-wise of a company, especially when you're doing work that's in the maintenance kind of phase of stuff, you're trying to optimize. But is there a point where, I've used teams in India, I've used teams across the planet, and it wasn't never really, though, for the cost savings. It was actually for being able to have access to those markets. It was simply that if we didn't have a development facility in India, it was harder to sell in India, as an example.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious, that mentality, though, of let's optimize the cost where it becomes inflexible, meaning we have to say no. Is that something as a trend? Is that still something that's being looked at in that geo? Is that still the dominant norm? Or is it, hey, you guys have a lot of talented people there, and let's go make sure that we add them to the team?
See, that is the second one, is the one they should do it, I think. But now with the AI, and then also the people want to, the companies I've seen it, they want really a end goal very quickly. I have funded this project $1 million, and I want a return on investment 6 months. No, and you cannot have it. You need to have a long-term, long-haul strategy to be in this project, to be in successful. This is for toying things out. Okay, let's send this development to India. We can, whether it's going to fail or win, we're not going to lose money because of the low cost. And that attitude, which I really don't like it, right? But it's happening.
In this regards, when we're saying the way to addressing an inhibitor like this, or this type of constraint, which I think cost is one factor, but then I think there's also the perception of, if I can get this done cheaper over here, I'm ignoring the fact that I might have a long-term slowdown. So
right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. It's like technical debt. if I build a lot of technical debt early on in my ideation phase and I don't address it and I continue to carry that debt forward, the overhead of that just continues to get worse and worse to the point where it's like all we're working on is defects as an organization. I see organizations do that all the time. So I'm curious, in your space today, where you work, do you think that the mentality is ship it at all costs, doesn't matter if we have high technical debt, or is this something that you believe that you have a different perspective on where it's, this isn't ready yet, so therefore it's not going out the door? I'm just curious.
Not that way. I know for the fact is we have million, I think it's a four-digit numbers of vulnerabilities. No, we're going to ship it anyway. We want to be in the market, you know.
So and first to market does have some of its benefits, but if you need Carl Sagan standing behind you going, the millions and billions of defects all coming together. Sorry, if that's a bad Carl Sagan. But okay, thank you for that perspective. I really appreciate it. If anyone else has other comments on this topic, please raise your hand, join the conversation, or you can put it into the chat as well, and we'll pick up on that. Diana, how are you? Happy Friday.
I'm doing well. Thank you. I am just sitting here basking and listening to Sheila and your wonderful comments and to Lassie about your kind of real life lived experience. And the other thing that's going on for me is, having been in this space for a really long time, I bounce back and forth from a historical perspective to a cutting edge perspective. I have a hard time staying in the present moment. But when that particular principle of the Agile Manifesto came up, and even before that, I think some of that came from the XP way of extreme programming, way of looking at the world and so on. The sense was people were constantly coming in, interrupting software developers' work. And they and the developers needed a way to respond to that on the team because, you know, they had a lot of experience being individual contributors, not team members. And so they had that. And so this, that we welcome changing requirements, was a way of saying, oh, you'd like us to work on this too? Okay, sure. We'll put it on the list. And then the need to continually be curating that list about what it is we're actually going to work on next. But it allowed the engineers and developers to be able to say yes instead of no. Of course, we welcome changing requirements. Give it to us and we'll go on our way. That's one thing I'm thinking about.
Well, just to dig in there real quick. I think that perspective, though, if you talk to most developers, do you think that they get that today?
No, I don't. I don't think that they get that. And I still end up finding myself saying, if you're working in and if you're using an agile approach to your work, here's a thing you get to do, right? And it often comes up in retrospectives and all that kind of thing. And it's fascinating to have watched how that kind of fairly simple, sure, we'll take it on, no problem. You want something different? We've got the flexibility to accommodate that, right? How that has become more and more complex. And like your whole list of the requirements for processes, the requirements for planning, the requirements for legacy, the requirements for that, I'm not sure that all of that was inherent in that one statement at the time. But of course it is now, right? Because times have changed. And the other thing that it's been coming up for me, because I am really interested in the ongoing experiment and of FAST, is how some of the ways that FAST differs from the way we've traditionally thought about teamwork and stuff, what impact it has on changing requirement, which is they just get accommodated every other day or so. If it's development requirements. Now, some of the other organizational requirements are things that I bump into a lot. And the inflexibility of organizations to consider changing some kinds of requirements like policies and procedures and those kinds of things in the face of that won't work if we're doing this. That's another aspect of this. And I think Sheila and you're both, and Tulasi all reflected that in their comments. I'm bouncing back and forth between what was and what will be and how are these changing requirements going to, because we're not going to eliminate them. If we're working in a complex space, which software development is, and I just got reminded that the other day we were talking about some things about Agile on a webinar, and man raised his hand and he said, yeah, but I work in manufacturing and we can't be doing all these changes and we have to do blah, blah, blah. And I said, this approach isn't appropriate for your work. If you've got repeatable, if you're building the same product over and over again in a repeatable process that you've refined and gotten to a good place, an agile approach isn't for you. It is for the folks who are constantly building new products that they don't really understand yet and that it's just emerging over time. And so the changing requirements aspect is never going away. How do we constantly, our question to ourselves is, I loved some of the things that Jörg was saying about techniques that he uses to help people manage that. And Sheila's observations about her system and being in that place of, I didn't put this in place, but now I have to deal with it. That's the nature of our work. And that's why I am saying all the time now, our work isn't knowledge work, it's learning work. Because as requirements change, we've got new things to learn every time. So
a couple of things you did pick up on what you were talking about there was, and I think it's interesting where the method that you pick could actually be the constraint. And the person who should be more embracing lean and
right,
removing waste from their system, which you should do that in Agile too, but maybe that's a more appropriate method. But I always thought about the constraint of the what ifs. Mm-hmm. And I'll point back to my days since I'm a Silicon head and spent a lot of time at Intel. Wouldn't it be nice if we could not have to remanufacture 26 different chips in order to go satisfy these 26 markets? What if we could just do one and then put a reprogrammable block on the CPU that allows us to change it the way that it works, the way that it'll function as a thing that would go into PC or a thing that would go into a Blade server or something that would go into something else? And I just remember those early days of that. How do we take the remove the constraint of the physical system, the hard system, and move it to the flexible side? And I think those would be some of the most rewarding projects that I've ever worked on, to just see suddenly now we have a reconfigurable block that's on there. Right. And guess what? We've just actually improved productivity. We've improved profitability for the organizations.
It makes me think of people who work in another kind of industry process environment, which is retail, and how often you might hear, oh, this would be a great job. I love hanging out in this shop if it weren't for all those pesky customers. And I think in software, we have to, and we've been struggling with it for well over 20 years now. How do we get out of that? If it weren't for these pesky customers changing their minds, having new needs, and embracing new technologies. If it weren't for that, wouldn't this be great?
That gets back to that learning culture thing that you just talked about, which is we just discovered through the process of releasing something that didn't fit the need that we've identified a market that we could potentially make a lot more money on if we just fix this one thing, which is amazing to me.
Right. But then you also end up with, we've got 26 markets and we need to configure this in 26 different ways. At some level, One of the things that I tell my clients all the time, and they don't necessarily thank me for it, is there is no perfect system. Every system has its upsides and its downsides. And the trick is find the one that has the most upsides with the least downsides. But you're never going to eliminate all the downsides, and you're never going to get all the upsides. There are no systems like that. And so what we have to do is take a more nuanced view and a learning view, like you say.
Yeah, and I think that's, and I think it's the flexibility component to this. And I'm going to leave this to everyone who's got an active microphone. When the system becomes rigid and suddenly we've got unhappy customers, unhappy developers, unhappy, everyone's unhappy, what's the way to break the logjam? How do you do that? Rochelle.
Let me repeat back the question so I can validate what you just said.
Okay.
You asked, when you get that resistance from your customers, how do you get them to move forward with you?
Yes. And actually, kind of a larger picture. So you get the rigidity with the customer, you get the rigidity suddenly with management, you get the rigidity then with developers, and everyone is sort of constrained with, we're all feeling very rigid. We can't move on these things fast. And so you can pick one of those vectors.
Sure.
But go for it.
Yeah. So what I have encountered with that is really coming at it with the what's in it for them, what's in it for me kind of approach from their perspective, right? And so I'm a release train engineer, don't boo me. But from that perspective, right, as taking the entirety of the product into account of how can we move forward together to move this entire product so that we can deliver something that you want, hopefully, it's to me about making sure that we're all on the same page. Hey, product team, do we want to make sure that we're delivering the best thing, or do we want to just deliver something? Mm-hmm. Because there's a difference, right? Do we want to deliver something of value, or do we just want to deliver something? Hopefully we want to deliver something of value over a thing. Right? Let's make the decision that is the thing that's actually going to make people happy, that's actually going to potentially get them out of your day-to-day. Because we don't necessarily want to have stakeholders and leaders, managers asking questions of your team on a daily basis. When's this going to happen? What's going on? Why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you doing that? Right? We mm-hmm. want to give them what they're asking for. So let's figure out a way that we can give them a small piece of that as fast as possible so that they see the progress and they are getting out something that is getting them to the direction that they want you to go. And having had that conversation with, honestly, multiple different teams, they go, oh, I just have to do this to get this leader, this executives out of my day-to-day business. And then it's not about how many story points have I delivered. It's about this is the value that I've delivered. Oh, I can do that, right? So it's shifting the way that they're thinking from I have to deliver this many story points or I have to deliver this story to I have to deliver this value. I have to deliver this workable thing. I have to show them what I'm doing every 2 weeks or whatever the case is. And from that leadership perspective, it's hey, you're asking for this quote unquote status report and really getting them to say, oh, I'm seeing this thing. It's not about the status. It's about the actual thing. Here's this architecture diagram, or here's this actual person in a box. Like I worked on an airplane development program, a literal person in a box mm-hmm. showing how this will change the way we're building an airplane or whatever that looks like, right? This is the true process improvement that we're doing. This is what this is going to look like, assuming that we're not shooting holes into it. Or here's these three best autoclaves. This is what the team is recommending. We either say yay or nay on this based on cost and requirements. And so it's really about what they are asking for and giving them that and really finding out and asking them that question directly. What are you looking for so that we can give it to you? you asking for another status report is not what you truly want. So let's talk about that. And let's find out how I can give you, how the teams can give you what you truly are looking for, so that you have confidence that the teams are doing what you want and need, and you can give them true feedback.
I love that perspective. I think one of the things that, as you talk to people most of the time and you ask them the question, and I found one uncomfortable conversation that I've had with a senior leader one time was, so what's the thing of value you've delivered in the last month? I was like, oh, okay, let me think about that. But if you had that mindset walking in, that you're looking for those things of value, or you're reflecting that a lot in order to understand what value is to the customer, I think that's a beautiful perspective. And thank you for adding that. We are at the top of the hour, everyone. We have a couple of announcements because we've had Diana Larson's been a part of our little community for a long period of time. And Diana, you've got something coming up, don't you, with the FAST community?
It's actually a two-day workshop, March 18th and 19th in Portland, Oregon, at a really cool venue called the Kennedy School, which has nothing to do with any of the political Kennedys, but a lot to do with a wonderful teacher whose last name is Kennedy. Anyway, FAST is a really new way of thinking about our work processes, and it includes a lot of kind of things, agile principles, and extends a bunch of them and adds in a lot of modern product management. And so we're going to have a workshop, a two-day workshop, the 18th and 19th in Portland, Oregon, to explore that more with people who are interested in staying out there on the cutting edge, with some of us who like hanging out there. And we have plenty of room and would love to see people from this Agile Coaching Network there, because I think your questions would be particularly incisive given my experience with this group over the past many months. Check it out.
Oh, groovy.
Yeah.
It'll be going out in the newsletter coming out next week. If you guys were familiar, the Agile Alliance is also another co-sponsor for this podcast. One of the things that they've been trying to do is the back to basics, getting the reinventing Agile. There's been a couple of webinars. One of the things I noticed from the FAST community and some of the other adjacent communities is that there's a lot of really great ideas that don't have to go back to the year 2001. There's actually some forward thinking groups that are out there. I strongly encourage, if you're not able to get to Portland, Oregon, would love to have you here, because I live in Portland, Oregon. It's a great place. But if you're not able to go do it, just go look at their website and go look at the materials underneath it. They've got some good stuff. The other thing is, if you guys are currently members of New Agility, the other kind of thing that's going on, and for where we talk ACN stuff on the other time, if you go to acnpodcast.org, you're actually redirected to New Agility, because that's where the hosting site is for that. We've also started to launch on there a better member experience. If you go up to that, if you're currently right now a subscriber of New Agility, if you came in through the podcast registration, but if you want to go ahead and just get a free membership to our membership area, it gives you a lot of exposure to upcoming webinars and other things that we're doing that are beyond just what we do in the ACN. One of those things is I'm teaching on March 12th, a mini workshop on maximizing productivity in remote and hybrid work environments. This is something that I've always worked remote throughout my career. I've never had my team all in one location. I would love to have had that at times, but I've always had to manage a global team across different areas. And I want to get a conversation and a mini workshop together and talk with a group of people about what are some of the strategies that are emergent and which things we should be adapting into our work group itself. Here again, you can go to newagility.com to make a reservation for that. One of the things, of course, go up to acnpodcast.org. If you haven't been a part of the ACN before, guess what? There's 87 episodes there. And like, got to admit that if you get through 87 episodes or 87 hours worth of content, that's a lot, but they're sequenced in a way where you can actually go find a particular topic that you might be interested in. Give it a listen. They're up online, please. Also, a lot of the different topics, we also are encouraging people to write blog posts. If you want to write a blog post for New Agility, you're welcome to send a blog post to us and we can get that up and posted to the bigger audience itself. With that, have a great month. ASEAN podcast is for educational and informative use only. If you'd like to know more about the ASEAN community, please come up to acnpodcast.org and support our show.